Regular listeners know that we like to cut through the punditry with some political science on the show now and again, and our next guest is well suited to help us with that effort. David Carroll is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland College Park, and he co-authored the book, a seminal book, I think, called The Party Decides Presidential Nominations Before and After Reform, which we've discussed on the show in the past. David, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
We've heard a lot this cycle about how the pundits have been dumbfounded by this or that trend, the rise of Bernie Sanders, Trump's seeming inability to say anything so outrageous that it hurts him among Republican primary voters, maybe the fact that evangelicals support Trump. Broadly speaking, do you think that political scientists are also asking what the heck is going on in this election, or does all of this kind of fit?
Well, I think that in real time, there's certainly been some startling developments. I think that Donald Trump is really a unique candidate, and that just has to be said. He doesn't fit a lot of paradigms and models. In some ways, every election is different. We try and generalize and find patterns. And I think when it's all said and done, there even this year, there will be a lot of resemblances to past years. But certainly, I think Trump has been a disruptive force in the Republican nomination process this year and has kept people off balance.
So let's talk a little bit more about the primaries. Can you just give our listeners a very brief bumper sticker summary of the Party Decides thesis?
Yeah, we argue that parties are coalitions of groups, of actors, people who care about public policy, who get together, form a united front to try and control the government. And it's our conception of parties is broader than looking at the formal structure, the party committees or just the elected officials. And what we found, is that the same kind of candidates that were nominated during the old days of the political conventions and the smoke-filled rooms have tended to be nominated even in the more wide-open process we've had since the 1970s, since the reforms after the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Most delegates are elected by voters in primaries or caucuses. The Mayor Daley's of yore are gone, but still the kind of candidates that have been chosen in both parties, broadly representative of all the interests within their party, lots of political experience, usually people who get along with other politicians, the kind of people who would have been nominated in the old days. So how did that happen? And we argue that during the year before the primaries, these party elites, activists, worked to get behind a candidate and help get him, or this time, her nominated. And usually there is that kind of a candidate who emerges. And the interesting thing this year is there is such a candidate on the Democratic side, and the Republican field has been much messier. I think it's consolidating now, but it had been a much messier process on the Republican side, whereas Hillary Clinton clearly is that person on the Democratic side.
Now, you define party actors much more broadly than just people working for the party. Right now, we have people in both parties kind of railing against the so-called establishment. They're saying the establishment is corrupt, the primary process is undemocratic. And the way you portray it in the book is not particularly nebulous or, it's not a corrupt system per se. It's just that these people are influencers, basically.
Right.
What do you make of these kind of attacks on the establishment?
Well, I think the term establishment is kind of unfortunate because on the Republican side, it's being used. See, we would say that the party elite includes, for example, social conservative leaders who are supporting Senator Ted Cruz. Dr. James Dobson, Tony Perkins, people like that are important forces in the Republican Party. And in any reasonable definition, they're part of it. But when people say the establishment in the Republican Party, they seem to mean the business community and elected officials and lobbyists. And that's part of it, but that's not the whole story. So I think, Trump really is a figure who is outside the Republican Party, except for a couple individuals. He has no support, really, from any segment of the party that we can identify at the elite level. Whereas Rubio certainly does, and Cruz also does. So I think, you know, like I said, I think the term establishment may be used on the Republican side in a kind of misleading way. On the Democratic side, it's interesting. When liberal interest groups endorsed Hillary Clinton, like Planned Parenthood. Right, and the Human Rights Campaign, the LGBT rights group, Bernie Sanders says, well, they're part of the establishment. And I think that's, in a way, that's misleading, in a way, that's right. Because establishment is a pejorative term, people got very upset about that. But of course, they are part of the establishment in a sense of the Democratic Party. They're aligned with the Democratic Party. They have activists. They have money. Their endorsement carries weight. They are players. And so I think that's true. I think they are, you know, they are part of it. But I think that's how parties work. And I think there's on the public level, there's kind of a, you know, in American political culture, parties are always very contested, especially since the Progressive Era. And there's this idea that really there shouldn't be parties, and the idea of parties is hard, you know, that everyone doesn't have a completely equal voice. You know, like you can be somebody who's not even registered with a party, shows up on one day, and you should have equal say. You know, to someone who's, you know, spent their life working for this party, organizing, raising money, you know, doing everything. So I think that's part of it. This, you know, this idea that establishment somehow is sinister.
I agree with that. And I think that, you know, people underestimate the degree to which a lot of Americans are tuned out of the political process. And I know it sounds elitist as hell for me to say it, but there are a lot of people who should not be deciding who is going to be the standard bearer for their party. There was a huge survey in the late 1990s about Americans' political knowledge. It found, I don't remember the exact number, so don't quote me, folks, but it was like 40% of the respondents could not tell you who the vice president was. And this was in 98, so Al Gore had been, you know, it was in the middle of his second term as vice president. So let me ask you this. If Trump were to pull this out and win, would that cast doubt on the Party Decides thesis?
Well, I think yes. I think that it would, at least it would say that maybe the pattern, the dynamics that we identified did not, you know, were not evident in this race. And then the question becomes, is it because the world has changed? You know, the book was written in 2008. We started writing it in 2001. It's possible, you know, the world evolves. Or is this, and this is really, in the case of Trump, this is more how where I would come down. And as opposed to Sanders, who we could talk about in a minute. But in the case of Trump, I would say it's more like, and I'm not predicting that he's going to be nominated, actually, but were he to be, that would be more like, I think, a very low probability event that could have happened, even in the period that we observed in the 80s and the 90s. Because Trump really is a unique figure. I mean, he's better known than any of the other Republican candidates before he even got in the race. He's better known than Jeb Bush, better known than anyone running except Hillary Clinton, and he's actually been famous even longer than her. And, you know, the two other factors were that the immigration issue has given him an opening, and that the Republican Party had not been able to coalesce around anyone else. You know, Jeb Bush, there were people who tried to make him the consensus candidate. He was unable to fill that role. Scott Walker flopped. Now I think Marco Rubio, you know, is moving into that position, but it's been quite slow. So I think it's only the combination of all these three factors that have come together to get Trump into the place that he's in now. And I think it's hard to identify any kind of long-term change. Like, it's not because of super PACs. Trump is not a super PAC guy. It's not because of social media. He's on Twitter, but he was famous before Twitter existed. You know, I really think Donald Trump is unique, and, you know, had the party not had a strong candidate in 1996, had there been a divisive issue that he could ride in on, he might have been able to do this, you know, many years ago. So I would say that's my, you know, interpretation, that this is kind of a low probability thing that has finally happened. And the big change that makes this possible is the opening up of the process after 1968. The fact that now you win delegates in primaries and open caucuses. So it's always, parties are always potentially vulnerable to a hostile takeover that Trump is trying to execute.
You know, I noted that the first season finale of The Apprentice, there were as many people that tuned in for the first season finale as voted in the entire Republican primaries in 2012. more people tuned into that episode than voted in the Republican primaries. So I think that his celebrity, his television fame has been somewhat overlooked among those who have been writing off his candidacy since the beginning. Now, you mentioned the super PACs. I want to read a brief quote to you. This is Nick Confessori writing in the New York Times. He writes, and I quote, "For the first time in recent history, insurgent candidates on both the left and the right are emerging from the Iowa caucuses with enough money to finance a strong offensive in the weeks ahead. What remains for the surviving contenders, particularly on the Republican side, are convoluted and extended paths to their party's nominations." And he notes that as of the end of December, the candidates and their allied super PACs had more than $288 million in cash on hand. So at this point, we've seen the field narrowing to a degree. Rand Paul dropped out, Huckabee. But I think it's safe to say that candidates like Carly Fiorina, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, and John Kasich would likely be out of the race, or at least on their last legs. Right now, only Christie appears to be really short on cash. So the Party Decides came out 2 years before Citizens United. Right. Do you think the influx of outside cash, you just said that it's not about that, but don't you think that the influx of outside cash from people who may not value a party's chances in the general election or may not perceive those chances the same way that the party's establishment, for the lack of a better word, do, might that not change the way we view this process?
Well, that is a possibility. It is, and the question is how big that effect is. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post in September saying that I didn't think that was going to be decisive. You know, Rick Perry had a super PAC. He still dropped out. Scott Walker still dropped out. And, you know, since then, as you pointed out, several other candidates on the Republican side have dropped out. And I think that after New Hampshire, I think probably Christie will be gone, Fiorina will be gone, Kasich maybe, you know, depending on how the vote goes. And Jeb Bush is the big question mark, because Jeb is the one with this monster super PAC. But he's, you know, if he does really, really badly, he has this super PAC. I don't know how much of an impact. It hurts Rubio if he stays in this scenario. So that's a possibility. It hasn't stopped a lot of candidates from dropping out, including candidates who had money left over. Rick Perry had money left over in the super PAC, and he still dropped out because he needed the hard money. So I just think, you know, it's too soon to say how big an effect that's going to be.
Now, on the Democratic side, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I think that it's clear that Hillary is the overwhelming favorite, although Bernie Sanders is widely expected to win New Hampshire. And I'm going to get, you know, people griping it to me on Facebook and whatnot for saying that, but that's the way it is. A lot of people who support Sanders are heartened by comparisons between this race and the 2008 primaries, which began with Hillary Clinton being seen as the heavy favorite and ended with a close win for Barack Obama. I personally see that as a very different race for a number of reasons, but I wonder what your view is.
Oh, I would agree with that. I don't think it's really as close. I think that she was never in as strong a position in 2008. She was never the overwhelming party choice the way she is this time. She had, let's say, the preponderance of support at that time, but it wasn't close to the level there were more unions supporting him, even though he was probably, Obama was maybe less union oriented than Sanders, more elected officials, more major fundraisers. He was seen from the beginning as a credible candidate where people with Sanders, a lot of people said, well, he's running to raise his issues. So, I agree with you. I think Sanders is favored in New Hampshire. But in general, I think Hillary is still in a strong position.
And people need to remember that Barack Obama delivered a keynote address in the 2004 Democratic National Convention and was seen, widely seen, as a rising star within the party before he got into that race. So the idea that he was the same sort of outsider candidate is really problematic. David, let me change gears here for a second. First of all, if you're just tuning in, I am speaking with David Carroll. Let's look ahead briefly to the general election, then I'll let you go. In the past couple of election cycles, there's been kind of this major change in election analysis. We've seen the rise of data-driven analysis. It's been a big deal. You get the Nate Silvers and all that. And I've noticed that during this cycle, we haven't heard much from the poli-sci fundamentalists. So that's the view. We had John Sides on to talk about this a little few months back. So that's the view that while the quality of candidates and the quality of campaigns do matter, obviously, they matter a lot less than most people think. And the fundamentalist perspective, more or less, and you can correct me if I'm not summarizing this accurately, is that if an outgoing president's approval rating and a handful of key economic indicators are decent or trending upwards, then that president's party will enter the race with a clear advantage. And if those things are headed south, then the out party will be favored to win. So has the emergence of Trump and Cruz and Sanders caused some people to rethink that view that candidates matter less than we thought?
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, none of these names you mentioned, none of them are yet the nominee.
No, I know.
And it's not clear that any of them will be. But what I think people probably would say is that if you have somebody who, considering generally the structural factors that you mentioned are more important than the candidate characteristics. But usually within the range of cases that we've seen that these models are built on, post-World War II elections, there aren't so many cases of really, who is remotely like Trump in that sample of cases, which is a small sample?
Yeah.
Nobody is remotely like Trump. With Cruz, you could say, well, maybe he's kind of like Barry Goldwater or like George McGovern. He appeals only to the hardcore of his party, and those candidates did very badly. Now, also the fundamental conditions you mentioned were working against them. It was time of peace, prosperity. I think that I don't think it's inconsistent to say that generally, when we're talking about kind of candidates within the normal scope of politics, like a Mitt Romney or a John McCain or a John Kerry, then these structural factors could be very important. And I think they'd be very important even if the nominee were to be somebody like Sanders or Trump or Cruz. But we just have fewer observations of cases like that. I mean, as a generalization, there's some evidence in political science that candidates that are seen as extremists pay some penalty. And I think that would happen to Cruz and that would happen to Sanders. Trump is just in a category of his own, I think.
Trump is certainly in a category of his own. For me, it takes some of the weight off of electability arguments. Or I should say this. It takes some of the confidence out of electability arguments. Because you hear a lot of people right now, they're saying, well, Sanders would get crushed. His agenda is relatively popular, and it depends on who he was up against. What happens if you have two candidates who are outside of the mainstream, as you say? We just don't know, do we?
Well, that's in presidential politics, we're probably in uncharted territory, and we haven't had the Goldwater versus McGovern election. But I think, in that case, then I think, if they're both seen as extremists, and there are other, there are other things about candidates that matter besides their ideological positioning, right? It mattered a lot that Kennedy was Catholic. It mattered, I think, somewhat less, but obviously it mattered that Obama is African-American, and it would matter that Hillary Clinton is a woman. So it's other things, so Bernie Sanders' age, could matter a little bit, especially he's going to be, if he runs against someone who's significantly younger, which both Cruz and Rubio are. Those things can matter a little bit as well. But yeah, of course, we haven't seen a contest like that. You could say, well, if they're both perceived as extremists, then these structural fundamental conditions matter, the economy and so on. But, those conditions matter the most when an incumbent is on the ballot, because people can attribute credit or blame to the president. We have peace, we have prosperity, or we don't. So it's his fault or it's to his credit. When it's somebody running, if Hillary Clinton or Sanders would run, as Obama's successor, those effects may not be as strong.
Now, is that equal for Hillary Clinton and Sanders, or would the fact that she served as his Secretary of State make her more like a vice presidential?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, look, I tend to think she would be more associated with Obama than Sanders would be. But again, that would just be my view, and we're so far from what we normally observe that I'm not sure. I mean, you have to go back, like, You know, in 1896, William James Bryan was nominated, and he was really not the candidate of the Grover Cleveland Democratic Party. Sanders is not as close to Obama as Clinton is, but he's not hostile to him. He says nice things about him. You know, in the debate, he refused. Hillary Clinton tried to say, if you're saying I'm not a progressive, then you're really saying Obama's not a progressive. And he wouldn't bite on that, you know. So, I'm not trying to punt, but this would be outside anything we've observed. I tend to think that Sanders would be viewed less as Obama's successor than she would be, even though she ran against Obama with his rival.
David Carroll, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It was good talking with you.